So I have a theory, and I'm wondering if you would accept this. And this is sort of based on my own experience, that the most powerful reading experiences are when you're quite young.
This is Steve Paulson.
You're a fairly innocent reader still. You don't have that much life experience that's going to sort of filter your response. And for me, at least, I read books all the time. I do it for work. But when I think back on those seminal reading experiences, I don't know if it can match the power of when I was 20 years old.
You know, that makes me sad. Steve is our executive producer, and he's also my husband. The man adores books. The idea that his peak reading is already behind him is kind of heartbreaking. But here's what another voracious reader has to say. Pamela Paul, editor of the New York Times Book Review.
I would absolutely agree with you, and on many levels. Let's take very, very young children. When you're a parent and you're looking at board books to show to your toddler, you might have this initial reaction of like, well, this book is about airplanes. My child actually hasn't been on an airplane yet, so I can't really read that because they're not going to know what it's about. They're not going to be able to relate to it. And yet, of course you can. That's how they become introduced to that concept. And then imagine then what it's like when they go on an airplane for the first time. Well, they've already seen it in a book. So you are encountering the world as a child through books before you actually encounter it in real life in many circumstances. They see people of all different walks of life first in books. And so the fundamental experience often for a child is first through the pages of books, which is a kind of amazing thing.
Yeah. That world of books can seem more real than your waking world that you look at.
That's the first encounter. And that's why I think that it is so smart that the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no screen time until at least the age of two. In part, I think, because there are many very good pedagogical reasons why they recommend that, but I would rather a child encounter it through the pages of a book first, have that experience first, than, let's say, on a website or on a TV show. And then you think about emotions and think about an older child, let's say a teenager, when you're experiencing really intense emotions for the first time in a lot of ways, especially related to love and sex, but also anger on a different level and just the full range. And when you read a novel that reflects those emotions and the intensity that mirrors the intensity that you as a teenager feel, that's a profound connection.
You're almost suggesting that we'll never match that reading experience when we were teenagers.
I mean, it's interesting. I'm in a book club that only reads children's literature. We go between sort of middle grade fiction, which is what we refer to. It has nothing to do with middle school. It's the term that essentially is like children's literature. Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe, A Wrinkle in Time, those are middle grade novels. That's what we think of as children's literature. And then we also read YA. And when I talk to some of my fellow members about why they like to read children's books, and they don't all have children, they don't all like children, why they want to read these books, it's because the intensity, the things that happen then, they feel so important at that time, and the rawness. And you can really go back and kind of feel that again. I mean, I think there's this whole new thing of crossover YA, of young adult fiction that adults read as well. And the book that most people think of when they think about that is John Green's The Fault in Our Stars. And that's a love story between two terminally ill or very ill cancer patients. So you know there's going to be some sadness. And I can, you know, I choke up even thinking about it, but it reminds you of what it's like to fall in love at that age for the first time.
When you were talking about a crossover book, I thought you were going to mention Philip Pullman's The Golden Compass.
Well, that's another great one. And there are also profound philosophical questions in that book. And that brings me to a third thing, which I think happens mostly in that sort of golden middle part, that children's literature world, which is fantasy and other worlds. And it's when you really, I think, begin to imagine that the world could be entirely different. There could be totally different rules. And I think that's why a lot of kids who later go on to read genre fiction or sometimes only read it in childhood, those kinds of fantasy, science fiction, adventure stories. It really is a kind of opening up of the world. You know, we become jaded over time, and of course, many of us will still continue to read in those genres and to have that total removal from time and space that we normally occupy. But it first happens when you're a child.
So I have a friend who's a retired children's book editor, and she says that by far the most important thing that has happened in the world of children's books, say over the last two decades, was Harry Potter. That just turned a whole new generation or multiple generations of kids into reading. Would you agree?
I think Harry Potter was a game changer for a number of reasons. I think that Harry Potter was the first time in a lifetime of, I would say, three generations now at this point, millennials, Gen X, and, you know, this latest generation, whether you want to call them the digital generation or Gen Z, but it was particularly strong for millennials and Gen X, where one of those series was coming out in real time in our lives, so that you had to wait between those stories for those installations. It's been a while since that happened. You know, that, yes, to a certain extent with Philip Pullman earlier in the Golden Compass, the Dark Materials series, and yes, with Narnia, those books were earlier, but this was the first time for these generations. And
I remember when my daughter was a teenager, this is back when Borders was still around, they would start the sale at midnight.
We
were there at midnight.
People would queue up. And that's the second thing, is that it was a communal experience. And it was a communal experience, again, for these two generations before the internet. The Harry Potter sort of phenomenon crossed over into the era of the internet, but really began before. The other major thing that Harry Potter did is that not only aged along with its readers, but it pulled grown-ups in as well. And it made Harry Potter into a kind of family experience, because the grown-ups wanted to know what the kids were reading, and the kids wanted to have their adults read the books to them before they could read them themselves. And people of all ages found that they enjoyed these books just as much. And I don't know, you know, you'd almost have to go back to things like Wilkie Collins and Dickens to, like, recapture the idea of, like, a real family reading experience, or maybe Little House on the Prairie. But there aren't many books that can capture people of all ages in that way. And so that was the first time, I really think, in the course of my lifetime, at least, that that's happened. Mm.
So I want to step back for a moment and come back to your history, your personal history as a reader. And you've talked about what you've called the book of books, where you've recorded every book that you've read since high school.
Yes. Bob, which is what I call him, which stands for Book of Books, was a blank book that I bought when I was a junior in high school, and I've been filling it out ever since, and I have gone back and started numbering them.
So why do you keep this list of all the books you've ever read since you were a junior in high school?
You know, I think at heart, I was a failed teenage diarist. I tried to keep a more traditional form of diary, and I, like any teenager, you know, who sort of thinks of herself as the writerly type, scribbling away like Joe March. And it turned out that I really was terrible as a teenage diarist. I only wrote when I was upset. And I was generally upset about the very ordinary things that teenage girls are upset about, you know, sleepovers that didn't happen and fights with your parents. And I would go back and reread these journals. And so ultimately, I decided, rather than write about the kind of ordinariness of my life at that time, I would write about where I often felt I really was, which was in the world of books. It was where I was psychologically, mentally, spiritually. I was in a drawing room in an English countryside, or running through a field, or traveling through another country. And so that's what I began to do.
You've had this, obviously, for years, for decades now. Do you feel like this is, to some degree, your autobiography?
Yeah. I don't remember the plots necessarily of each of those books, but I remember everything around it. I remember what the book looked like. I remember where I bought it. I remember or borrowed it, or who gave it to me. I remember why I read it at that moment. And I remember where I was when I read them. I remember if I was on a beach or if I was reading it on a bus. It all comes back to me.
Pamela Paul is the author of How to Raise a Reader, and she's the editor of the New York Times Book Review.